Elon Musk and the True History of the ADL. Mike Whitney Interview with Ron Unz. Published September 13th, 2023 in the Unz Review. Question 1. The Nature of the ADL. Let's talk about the ADL. Some of your readers may not know that you have written extensively on the ADL and that your analysis prompted Paul Craig Roberts to call you the bravest man I know. What Roberts was referring to, I think, was your riveting 2018 account of the ADL's shadowy history as well as its controversial activities and methods. Here's a short excerpt from a piece you wrote in 2018 that helps to illustrate what I'm talking about. In January 1993, the San Francisco Police Department reported that it recently raided the Northern California headquarters of the ADL based upon information provided by the FBI. The SFPD discovered that the organization had been keeping intelligence files on more than 600 civic organizations and 10,000 individuals, overwhelmingly of a liberal orientation, with the SFPD inspector estimating that 75% of the material had been illegally obtained, much of it by secret payments to police officials. This was merely the tip of the iceberg in what was clearly amounting to the largest domestic spying operation by any private organization in American history. And according to some sources, ADL agents across the country had targeted over 1,000 political, religious, labor, and civil rights organizations, with the New York headquarters of the ADL maintaining active dossiers on more than a million Americans. This is shocking information that perhaps only a handful of Americans know anything about. The recent dust-up with Elon Musk has put the ADL's methods under a microscope, particularly their alleged role in censoring people on the Internet. So my question to you is this. What is the ADL? Is it really a civil rights organization that combats extremism and anti-Semitism, or is it something else altogether? Ron Unz. Founded in 1913, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, is a very formidable Jewish activist organization that has great influence over the media and other important elements of American society, and therefore is widely feared in elite circles. As I explained in my 2018 article, in our modern era, there are surely few organizations that so terrify powerful Americans as the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, of B'nai B'rith, a central organ of the organized Jewish community. Mel Gibson had long been one of the most popular stars in Hollywood, and his 2004 film, The Passion of the Christ, became among the most profitable in world history. Yet the ADL and its allies destroyed his career, and he eventually donated millions of dollars to Jewish groups in desperate hopes of regaining some of his public standing. When the ADL criticized a cartoon that appeared in one of his newspapers, media titan Rupert Murdoch provided his personal apology to that organization, and the editors of The Economist quickly retracted a different cartoon once it came under ADL fire. Billionaire Tom Perkins, a famed Silicon Valley venture capitalist, was forced to issue a heartfelt apology after coming under ADL criticism for his choice of words in a Wall Street Journal column. These were all proud, powerful individuals, and they must have deeply resented being forced to seek such abject public forgiveness, but they did so nonetheless. The total list of ADL supplicants over the years is a very long one. Because of its media influence, the ADL's coverage has almost always been extremely favorable, portraying it as one of America's leading watchdogs against dangerous extremism, especially anti-Semitism or racism. Given this powerful positive image, the ADL successfully gained the role of content gatekeeper at some of America's largest internet companies, helping to determine what may or may not be said on such important platforms as Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Indeed, a few years ago, Silicon Valley's San Jose Mercury News profiled the ADL director who was responsible for policing hate speech across the American-dominated global internet. Meanwhile, that same media influence has ensured that only very few people have ever become aware of the organization's long history of illegal spying upon enormous numbers of Americans, including such notable figures as Martin Luther King Jr. I discussed this in my 2018 article. The choice of the ADL as the primary ideological overseer of America's internet may seem natural and appropriate to politically ignorant Americans, a category that unfortunately includes the technology executives leading the companies involved. But this reflects the remarkable cowardice and dishonesty of the American media from which all these individuals derive their knowledge of the world. The true history of the ADL is actually a sordid and disreputable tale. In January 1993, the San Francisco Police Department reported it had recently raided the Northern California headquarters of the ADL, based upon information provided by the FBI. The SFPD discovered that the organization had been keeping intelligence files on more than 600 civic organizations and 10,000 individuals, overwhelmingly of a liberal orientation, with the SFPD inspector estimating that 75% of the material had been illegally obtained, much of it by secret payments to police officials. This was merely the tip of the iceberg in what clearly amounted to the largest domestic spying operation by any private organization in American history, and according to some sources, ADL agents across the country had targeted over 1,000 political, religious, labor, and civil rights organizations, with the New York headquarters of the ADL maintaining active dossiers on more than 1 million Americans. Not long afterwards, an ACLU official who had previously held a high-ranking position with the ADL revealed in an interview that his organization had been the actual source of the highly controversial 1960s surveillance on Martin Luther King Jr., which had then provided to FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. For many years, Hoover had been furiously denounced in the national media headlines for his use of tapes and other secret information on King's activities. But when a local San Francisco newspaper revealed that an ADL spying operation had actually been the source of all that sordid material, the bombshell revelation was totally ignored in the national media and only reported by fringe organizations, so that today almost no Americans are aware of that fact. I know of no other private organization in American history that has been involved in even a sliver of such illegal domestic espionage activity, which appears to have been directed against almost all groups and prominent individuals, left, right, and center, suspected of being insufficiently aligned with Jewish and Israeli interests. Some of the illegal material found in the ADL's possession even raised dark suspicions that it played a role in domestic terrorist attacks and political assassinations directed against foreign leaders. I am no legal expert, but given the massive scale of such illegal ADL activities, I wonder whether a plausible case might have been made to prosecute the entire organization under RICO statutes and sentence all of its leaders to long prison terms. Instead, the resulting government charges were quickly settled with merely a trivial fine and a legal slap on the wrist, demonstrating the near total impunity provided by massive Jewish political power in modern American society. In effect, the ADL seems to have long operated as a privatized version of our country's secret political police, monitoring and enforcing its ideological doctrines on behalf of Jewish groups, much as the Stasi did for the communist rulers of East Germany. Given such a long history of criminal activity, allowing the ADL to extend its oversight to our largest social media platforms amounts to appointing the mafia to supervise the FBI and the NSA, or taking a very large step towards implementing George Orwell's Ministry of Truth on behalf of Jewish interests. In his 1981 memoirs, the far-right classic scholar Revilla P. Oliver characterized the ADL as the formidable organization of Jewish cowboys who ride herd on their American cattle, and this seems a reasonably apt description to me. American Pravda, the ADL in American society. The ADL censors the internet and hides its sordid past. Ron Unz, The Unz Review, October 15, 2018, 7,300 words. Question 2, the origins of the ADL. Could you give us a thumbnail sketch of the origins of the ADL so that readers have a more informed view of the organization's history? Ron Unz. Earlier this year, both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal gave considerable space to the coverage of Parade, the revival of a 1998 Broadway musical on the 1915 killing of Leo Frank, a Jewish factory manager in Atlanta, Georgia, arguably the most famous lynching in American history. Frank had been convicted and sentenced to death for the rape and murder of a young girl in his employ, and the ADL was founded in an effort to save his life. After numerous legal appeals failed, the state's governor eventually commuted Frank's sentence, and a group of outraged citizens responded by hanging Frank. The incident was portrayed in both the musical and past decades of media coverage as a particularly horrifying example of American anti-Semitism. According to this near-universal media narrative, despite this initial failure, the ADL then spent the next 100 years leading the struggle against both anti-Semitism and racism. However, the true facts of the Leo Frank case were very different from what had been presented, and understanding the real history provides important insights into the actual nature of the ADL and its activities. Moreover, the ADL's long success in concealing those facts demonstrates the power the organization exercises over the media and the academic community. The ADL is inseparable from the Leo Frank case that inspired its creation, and earlier this year I explained those circumstances. The basic outline of events is not disputed. In 1913, Georgia, a 13-year-old pencil company worker named Mary Fagan was last seen alive visiting the office of factory manager Leo Frank on a Saturday morning to collect her weekly paycheck, while her raped and murdered body was found in the basement early the next morning, and Frank eventually arrested for the crime. As the wealthy young president of the Atlanta chapter of B'nai B'rith, Frank ranked as one of the most prominent Jewish men in the South, and great resources were deployed in his legal defense. But after the longest and most expensive trial in state history, he was quickly convicted and sentenced to death. The facts of the case against Frank eventually became a remarkable tangle of complex and often conflicting evidence and eyewitness testimony, with sworn statements regularly being retracted and then counter-retracted. But the crucial point that the NOI authors emphasize for properly deciphering this confusing situation is the enormous scale of the financial resources that were deployed on Frank's behalf, both prior to the trial and afterward, with virtually all of the funds coming from Jewish sources. Currency conversions are hardly precise, but relative to the American family incomes of the time, the total expenditures by Frank's supporters may have been as high as $25 million in present-day money, quite possibly more than any other homicide defense in American history, before or after, and an almost unimaginable sum for the impoverished Deep South of that period. Years later, a leading donor privately admitted that much of this money is spent on perjury and similar falsifications, something which is very readily apparent to anyone who closely studies the case. When we consider this vast ocean of pro-Frank funding and the sordid means for which it was often deployed, the details of the case become far less mysterious. There exists a mountain of demonstrably fabricated evidence and false testimony in favor of Frank, and no sign of anything similar on the other side. The police initially suspected the Black Night Watchman who found the girl's body, and he was quickly arrested and harshly interrogated. Soon afterwards, a bloody shirt was found at his home, and Frank made several statements that seemed to implicate his employee in the crime. At one point, this black suspect may have come close to being summarily lynched by a mob, which would have closed the case. But he stuck to his story of innocence with remarkable composure, in sharp contrast to Frank's extremely nervous and suspicious behavior, and the police soon shifted their scrutiny towards the latter, culminating in his arrest. All researchers now recognize that the night watchman was entirely innocent, and the evidence against him planted. The case against Frank steadily mounted. He was the last man known to have seen the young victim, and he repeatedly changed important aspects of his story. Numerous former female employees reported his long history of sexually aggressive behavior towards them, especially directed towards the murdered girl herself. At the time of the murder, Frank claimed to have been working alone in his office, but a witness who went there reported he had been nowhere to be found. A vast amount of circumstantial evidence implicated Frank. A Black Frank family servant soon came forward with sworn testimony that Frank had confessed the murder to his wife on the morning after the killing, and this claim seemed supported by the latter's strange refusal to visit her husband in jail for the first 2 weeks after the day of his arrest. Two separate firms of experienced private detectives were hired by Frank's lavishly funded partisans, and the agents of both eventually came to the reluctant conclusion that Frank was guilty as charged. As the investigation moved forward, a major break occurred as a certain Jim Conley, Frank's black janitor, came forward and confessed to having been Frank's accomplice in concealing the crime. At the trial, he testified that Frank had regularly enlisted him as a lookout during his numerous sexual liaisons with his female employees, and after murdering Fagan, Frank had then offered him a huge sum of money to help remove and hide the body in the basement so that the crime could be pinned on somebody else. But with the legal noose tightening around Frank, Conley had begun to fear that he might be made the new scapegoat, and went to the authorities in order to save his own neck. Despite Conley's damning accusations, Frank repeatedly refused to confront him in the presence of the police, which was widely seen as further proof of Frank's guilt. By the time of the trial itself, all sides were agreed that the murderer was either Frank, the wealthy Jewish businessman, or Conley, the semi-literate black janitor with a first-grade education and a long history of public drunkenness and petty crime. Frank's lawyers exploited this comparison to the fullest, emphasizing Frank's Jewish background as evidence for his innocence and indulging in the crudest sort of racial invective against his black accuser, whom they claimed was obviously the true rapist and murderer due to his bestial nature. Those attorneys were the best that money could buy, and the lead counsel was known as one of the most skilled courtroom interrogators in the South. But although he subjected Conley to a grueling 16 hours of intense cross-examination over 3 days, the latter never wavered in the major details of his extremely vivid story, which deeply impressed the local media and the jury. Meanwhile, Frank refused to take the stand at his own trial, thereby avoiding any public cross-examination of his often-changing account. Two notes written in crude black English had been discovered alongside Fagan's body, and everyone soon agreed that these were written by the murderer in hopes of misdirecting suspicion. So they were either written by a semi-literate black such as Conley, or by an educated white attempting to imitate that style. And to my mind, the spelling and choice of words strongly suggest the latter, thereby implicating Frank. Taking a broader overview, the theory advanced by Frank's legion of posthumous advocates seems to defy rationality. These journalists and scholars uniformly argue that Conley, a semi-literate black menial, had brutally raped and murdered a young white girl, and that the legal authorities soon became aware of this fact, but conspired to set him free by supporting a complex and risky scheme to instead frame an innocent white businessman. Can we really believe that the police officials and prosecutors of a city in the Old South would have violated their oath of office in order to knowingly protect a black rapist and killer from legal punishment, and thereby turn him loose upon their city streets, presumably to prey upon future white young girls? This implausible reconstruction is particularly bizarre in that nearly all of its advocates across the decades have been the staunchest of Jewish liberals, who have endlessly condemned the horrific racism of the Southern authorities of that era, but then unaccountably choose to make a special exception in this one particular case. In many respects, the more important part of the Frank case began after his conviction and death sentence, when many of America's wealthiest and most influential Jewish leaders began mobilizing to save him from the hangman. They soon established the ADL as a new vehicle for that purpose and succeeded in making the Frank murder case one of the most famous in American history to that date. Although his role was largely concealed at the time, the most important new backer whom Frank attracted was Albert Lasker of Chicago, the unchallenged monarch of American consumer advertising, which constituted the life's blood of all of our mainstream newspapers and magazines. Not only did he ultimately provide the lion's share of the funds for Frank's defense, but he focused his energies upon shaping the media coverage surrounding the case. Given his dominant business influence in that sector, we should not be surprised that a huge wave of unremitting pro-Frank propaganda soon began appearing across the country in both local and national publications, extending to most of America's most popular and highly regarded media outlets, with scarcely a single word told on the other side of the story. This even included all of Atlanta's own leading newspapers, which suddenly reversed their previous positions and became convinced of Frank's innocence. Lasker also enlisted other powerful Jewish figures in the Frank cause, including New York Times owner Adolph Oakes, American Jewish Committee President Louis Marshall, and leading Wall Street financier Jacob Schiff. The Times in particular began devoting enormous coverage to this previously obscure Georgia murder case, and many of its articles were widely republished elsewhere. The NOI authors highlight this extraordinary national media attention. The black janitor whose testimony became central to Leo Frank's conviction became the most quoted black person in American history up to that time. More of his words appeared in print in the New York Times than those of W.E.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, and Booker T. Washington combined. Back a century ago, just to today, our media creates our reality. and with Frank's innocence being proclaimed nationwide in near unanimous fashion, a long list of prominent public figures were soon persuaded to demand a new trial for the convicted murderer, including Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, and Jane Addams. Ironically enough, Lasker himself plunged into this crusade despite apparently having very mixed personal feelings about the man whose cause he was championing. His later biography reveals that upon his first personal meeting with Frank, he perceived him as a pervert and a disgusting individual, so much so that he even hoped that after he managed to free Frank, the latter would quickly perish in some accident. Furthermore, in his private correspondence, he freely admitted that a large fraction of the massive funding that he and numerous other wealthy Jews from across the country were providing had been spent on perjured testimony, and there were also strong hints that he explored bribing various judges. Given these facts, Lasker and Frank's other major backers were clearly guilty of serious felonies, and could have received lengthy prison terms for their illegal conduct. With the New York Times and the rest of the liberal northern media now providing such heavy coverage of the case, Frank's defense team was forced to abandon the racially inflammatory rhetoric aimed at his black accuser, which had previously been the centerpiece of their trial strategy. Instead, they began concocting a tale of rampant local anti-Semitism, previously unnoticed by all observers, and adopted it as major grounds for their appeal of the verdict. The unprincipled legal methods pursued by Frank's backers is illustrated by a single example. Georgia law normally required that a defendant be present in court to hear the reading of the verdict. But given the popular emotions in the case, the judge suggested that this provision be waived, and the prosecution assented only if the defense lawyers promised not to use the small irregularity as grounds for appeal. But after Frank was convicted, American Jewish Committee President Marshall and his other backers orchestrated numerous unsuccessful state and federal appeals on exactly this minor technicality, merely hiring other lawyers to file the motions. For almost 2 years, the nearly limitless funds deployed by Frank's supporters covered the costs of 13 separate appeals on the state and federal levels, including to the U.S. Supreme Court, while the national media was used to endlessly vilify Georgia's system of justice in the harshest possible terms. Naturally, this soon generated a local reaction, and during this period, outraged Georgians began denouncing the wealthy Jews who were spending such enormous sums to subvert the local criminal justice system. One of the very few journalists willing to oppose Frank's position was Georgia publisher Tom Watson, a populist firebrand, and in an editorial he reasonably declared, "We cannot have one law for the Jew and another for the Gentile," while he also lamented that it is a very bad state of affairs when the idea gets abroad that the law is too weak to punish a man who has plenty of money. A former Georgia governor indignantly inquired, "Are we to understand that anybody except a Jew can be punished for a crime?" The clear facts indicate that there was indeed a massive miscarriage of justice in Frank's case, but virtually all of it occurred in Frank's favor. All appeals were ultimately rejected, and Frank's execution date for the rape and murder of the young girl finally drew near. But just days before he was scheduled to leave office, Georgia's outgoing governor commuted Frank's sentence, provoking an enormous storm of popular protest, especially since he was the business partner of Frank's chief defense lawyer, an obvious conflict of interest. Given the enormous funds that Frank's national supporters had been deploying on his behalf, and the widespread past admissions of bribery in the case, there are obviously dark suspicions about what had prompted such a remarkably unpopular decision, which soon forced the former governor to exile himself from the state. A few weeks later, a group of Georgia citizens stormed Frank's prison farm, abducting and hanging him, with Frank becoming the first and only Jew lynched in American history. Naturally, Frank's killing was roundly denounced in the national media that had long promoted his cause. But even in those quarters, there may have been a significant difference between public and private sentiments. No newspaper in the country had been more strongly championing Frank's innocence than the New York Times of Adolph Oakes. Yet according to the personal diary of one of the Times editors, Oakes privately despised Frank and perhaps even greeted his lynching with a sense of relief. No effort was ever made by Frank's wealthy supporters to bring any of the lynching party to justice. American Pravda, the Leo Frank case and the origins of the ADL. Ron Unz, The Unz Review, March 27, 2023, 5,300 words. Question 3. The implications of the Leo Frank case. What is the real importance of the Leo Frank case, which led to the founding of the ADL? Ron Unz. Once we discover the true history of the Leo Frank case and the origins of the ADL, I think the broader implications are profound. For more than 100 years, the ADL has successfully portrayed itself as an anti-racist organization dedicated to safeguarding the rights of all Americans, including American blacks. But the truth is exactly the opposite. And when we recognize that the ADL has managed to conceal that reality for more than four generations, we better understand the sort of control the organization has long exercised over both the media and the academic community. Seen in its proper light, the Leo Frank case marked a huge milestone in the history of black-white relations in America. But that significance has deliberately been kept hidden. I discussed the importance of the case in 2018. The NOI authors devote nearly all of their lengthy book to a careful analysis of the Frank case, provided in suitably dispassionate form, but a sense of their justifiable outrage does occasionally poke through. In the years prior to Frank's killing, many thousands of black men throughout the South had been lynched, often based on a slender thread of suspicion, with few of these incidents receiving more than a few sentences of coverage in a local newspaper, and large numbers of whites had also perished under similar circumstances. Meanwhile, Frank had received benefit of the longest trial in modern Southern history, backed by the finest trial lawyers that money could buy, and based on overwhelming evidence, had been sentenced to death for the rape and murder of a young girl. But when Frank's legal verdict was carried out by extrajudicial means, he immediately became the most famous lynching victim in American history, perhaps even attracting more media attention than all those thousands of other cases combined. Jewish money and Jewish media established him as a Jewish martyr, who thereby effectively usurped the victimhood of the enormous numbers of innocent blacks who were killed both before and after him, none of whom were even ever recognized as individuals. As Professor Shahak has effectively demonstrated, traditional Talmudic Judaism regarded all non-Jews as being subhuman, with their lives possessing no value. Given that Frank's backers were followers of Reform Judaism, it seems quite unlikely that they accepted this doctrine, or even were aware of its existence. But religious traditions of 1,000 years standing can easily become embedded within a culture, and such unrecognized cultural sentiments may have easily shaped their reaction to Frank's legal predicament. In their introduction, the NOI authors make the fascinating point that the larger historical meaning of the Frank case in American racial history has been entirely lost. Prior to that trial, it was unprecedented for Southern courts to allow black testimony against a white man, let alone a wealthy white man being tried on serious charges. But the horrific nature of the crime and Conley's role as the sole witness required a break from that long-standing tradition. Thus, the authors not unreasonably argued that the Frank case may have been as important to the history of black progress in America as such landmark legal verdicts as Plessy v. Ferguson or Brown v. Board. But since almost the entire historical narrative had been produced by fervent Jewish advocates, these facts have been completely obscured and the case willfully misrepresented as an example of anti-Semitic persecution and public murder. Let us summarize what seems to be the solidly established factual history of the Frank case, quite different than the traditional narrative. There is not the slightest evidence that Frank's Jewish background was a factor behind his arrest and conviction, nor the death sentence he received. This case set a remarkable precedent in Southern courtroom history, with the testimony of a black man playing a central role in a white man's conviction. From the earliest stages of the murder investigation, Frank and his allies continually attempted to implicate a series of different innocent blacks by planting false evidence and using bribes to solicit perjured testimony, while the exceptionally harsh racial rhetoric that Frank and his attorneys directed towards those blacks was presumably intended to provoke their public lynching. Yet despite all these attempts by the Frank forces to play upon the notorious racial sentiments of the white Southerners of that era, the latter saw through these schemes, and Frank was the one sentenced to hang for his rape and murder of that young girl. Now suppose that all the facts of this famous case were exactly unchanged, except that Frank had been a white Gentile. Surely the trial would be ranked as one of the greatest racial turning points in American history, perhaps even overshadowing Brown v. Board because of the extent of popular sentiment, and it would have been given a central place in all of our modern textbooks. Meanwhile, Frank, his lawyers, and his heavy financial backers would probably be cast as among the vilest racial villains in all of American history, for their repeated attempts to foment the lynching of various innocent blacks so that a wealthy white rapist and murderer could walk free. But because Frank was Jewish rather than Christian, this remarkable history has been completely inverted for over 100 years by our Jewish-dominated media and historiography. These are the important consequences that derive from control of the narrative and flow of information, which allows murderers to be transmuted into martyrs and villains into heroes. The ADL was founded just over a century ago with the central goal of preventing a Jewish rapist and killer from being held legally accountable for his crimes. And over the decades, it eventually metastasized into a secret political police force not entirely dissimilar from the widely despised East German Stasi, but with its central goal seeming to be the maintenance of overwhelming Jewish control in a society that is 98% non-Jewish. We should ask ourselves whether it is appropriate for an organization with such origins and such recent history to be granted enormous influence over the distribution of information across our internet. American Pravda, the Leo Frank case and the origins of the ADL. Ron Unz, The Unz Review, March 27, 2023, 5,300 words. Question 4, the influence of the ADL. Here's a short quote from one of your articles that questions whether the ADL has the moral standing to act as the Internet's de facto thought police. In effect, the ADL seems to have long operated as a privatized version of our country's secret political police, monitoring and enforcing its ideological doctrines on behalf of Jewish groups, much as the Stasi did for the communist rulers of East Germany. Given such a long history of criminal activity, allowing the ADL to extend its oversight to our largest social media platforms amounts to appointing the mafia to supervise the FBI and the NSA, or taking a very large step towards implementing George Orwell's Ministry of Truth on behalf of Jewish interests. This is the most scathing indictment of the ADL I've ever read. If you're right, then we must assume that combating extremism and hate is merely a fig leaf concealing the organization's real objective, which is to censor anyone whose views do not align with those of the ADL. Is that how you see it? Is the real purpose of the ADL to silence anyone with whom it disagrees? Ron Unz. Yes, the ADL has maintained its power by extremely effective censorship blockade it maintains on all contrary information. Once I began investigating the origins of the ADL and the Leo Frank case, I discovered that the only account challenging the established mainstream narrative came from a totally unexpected source. As I explained in late 2018, mainstream publishers may often reject books that too sharply conflict with reigning dogma, and sales of such works are unlikely to justify the extensive research required to produce the manuscript. Furthermore, both authors and publishers may face widespread vilification from a hostile media for taking such positions. For these reasons, those who publish such controversial material will often be acting from deep ideological motives rather than merely seeking professional advancement or monetary gain. As an example, it took a zealous Trotskyite leftist such as Leni Brenner to brave the risk of ferocious attacks and invest the time and effort to produce his remarkable study of the crucial Nazi-Zionist partnership of the 1930s. And for similar reasons, we should not be totally surprised that the leading book arguing for the guilt of Leo Frank appeared as a volume in a series on the pernicious aspects of Jewish-Black historical relations produced by Louis Farrakhan's Nation of Islam, nor that the text lacked any identified author. Anonymous works published by heavily demonized religious political movements naturally engender considerable caution. But once I began reading the 500 pages of the Leo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, I was tremendously impressed by the quality of the historical analysis. I think I have only very rarely encountered a research monograph on a controversial historical event that provided such an enormous wealth of carefully argued analysis, backed by such copious evidence. The authors seemed to display complete mastery of the major secondary literature of the last 100 years, while drawing very heavily upon the various primary sources, including court records, personal correspondence, and contemporaneous publications, with the overwhelming majority of the 1,200 footnotes referencing newspaper and magazine articles of the era. The case they made for Frank's guilt seemed absolutely overwhelming. The weighty historical text that so impressed me had been published a couple of years earlier and received relatively little attention. But my article highlighting its importance soon attracted a great deal of readership and interest, and as I later explained, this may have prompted the ADL into having it banned from Amazon. But for me, the most remarkable ADL revelation came in a book I purchased last year on Amazon, a book Amazon has now banned from sale. It seems that the ADL's very origin story of 100 years ago, frequently mentioned in my introductory history textbooks and which I had never previously questioned, actually represented an absolute inversion of historical reality. Prior to the creation of the Internet and the establishment of Amazon's book-selling operation, this fascinating history would have remained completely unknown to me. Given its influential political role in our society, the ADL would certainly be concerned if it became widely known that the organization was founded with the central mission of ensuring that no wealthy and powerful Jew ever suffered punishment for the rape and murder of a young Christian girl, nor for trying to orchestrate the lynching of innocent black men in order to cover his own guilt. When I published my original article in October, I naturally encouraged readers to order the remarkable book in question and decide for themselves. But Amazon has now chosen to ban the book of outstanding black historical scholarship at the height of Black History Month, a step taken just a few days after the ADL president made his annual glowing tribute to that national celebration of black pride. Those interested can still read my lengthy analysis of that book and the important historical event it describes. American Pravda, Amazon Book Censorship, Banning Black Historiography During Black History Month. Ron Unz, The Unz Review, March 11, 2019, 7,600 words. The ADL usually launches ferocious public attacks against any individuals or publications that challenge its authority. But if such tactics of intimidation fail, the ADL then apparently reverts to a fallback strategy of blackout and censorship, working to absolutely minimize the visibility and reach of its antagonists, such as by having their books banned by Amazon. In my own case, after the initial attacks failed, the organization seemed to have prohibited any mention of our website or my writings from all those publications under its strong influence. Eventually, both Facebook and Google, the two leading gatekeepers of the global Internet, banned or deranked all of our pages, making it very difficult for people to discover our website. I've described the very bizarre aspect of this media blackout, which I call the Lord Voldemort effect. This hypothesis was strongly supported by a second incident later that same month. We had previously published an article by Professor Eric Rasmussen of Indiana University, and I read in my Morning Times that he had suddenly become embroiled in a major Internet controversy, with a chorus of angry critics seeking to have him removed. According to the article, he'd apparently promoted the vile and stupid views of some anti-feminist website in one of his tweets, which had come to the attention of an enraged activist. The resulting firestorm of denunciations on Twitter had been viewed 2.5 million times, provoking a major academic controversy in the national media. Being curious about what had happened, I contacted Rasmussen to see whether he might want to submit a piece regarding the controversy, which he did. But to my utter astonishment, I discovered that the website involved had actually been our own, a fact that I never would have suspected from the extremely vague and circuitous discussion provided in the newspaper. Apparently, the old-fashioned who-what-where provisions of the Times Style Manual had been quietly amended to prohibit providing any hint of our existence, even when we were at the absolute center of one of the 1,000-word news stories. Ideological Purges and the Lord Voldemort Effect. Ron Unz, The Unz Review, March 11, 2019, 7,600 words. Question 5. How to cope with the ADL? What suggestions would you give Elon Musk for handling the ADL in this current confrontation? Ron Unz. I think the power of the ADL comes from the influence it exerts over the media and other information choke points of our society. But that influence is almost entirely based upon a compelling set of falsehoods regarding the origins of the ADL and its activities over the decades since its founding. As I've said, suppose it became widely known that the organization was founded with the central mission of ensuring no wealthy and powerful Jew ever suffered punishment for the rape and murder of a young Christian girl, nor for trying to orchestrate the lynching of innocent black men in order to cover his own guilt. Or if the public discovered that an ACLU official who had previously held a high-ranking position with the ADL revealed in an interview that his organization had been the actual source of the highly controversial 1960 surveillance on Martin Luther King Jr., which had then provided to FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Under these circumstances, I think that much of the power and influence of the ADL would quickly evaporate under the strong sunlight of such public scrutiny. Perhaps the organization itself might suffer severe internal stress. I doubt if more than a tiny sliver of the American public is aware of the true history of the ADL. But exactly that same condition of ignorance may also exist among the ADL employees, activists, and donors. Almost all of those individuals probably derive their knowledge of their own organization's history and activities from the same biased media publications and sanitized accounts as does the general public. Even a large majority of the ADL leadership may be completely shocked by the facts I am providing in this interview, and they might grow fearful of the consequences if this information became public knowledge. Some of them might consider resigning out of such concerns. After the ADL posted their rather milquetoast criticism of my activities produced by an anonymous staffer, I responded by publishing a lengthy history of their own organization. As a result, they immediately abandoned the battle and avoided any further engagement. Unlike myself or my publication, Elon Musk controls one of the world's most powerful media megaphones. If he chose to do so, he could easily ensure that tens of millions of Americans learn the true origins and history of the ADL, an organization that today controls much of what our citizens are allowed to see or read. Such a bold stroke might completely break the power the ADL possesses over him and the rest of our society.